Welcome to Real Talk JavaScript, the weekly talk show that brings you stories of real-world development from industry experts and developers like you and me. Each week, Ward Bell, Dan Wallin, Craig Shoemaker, and John Papa find out what it takes to write, deploy, and maintain apps that stand up to the demands of the real world. And now, here are your hosts.
Welcome back to Real Talk JavaScript. This is episode 76, and it's going to be all about readable JavaScript, or aka the JavaScript world, according to Lori Barth. So we're going to have a fun time today. We've had a really good chat before the show here, and I've got to introduce my co-host today, the famous crooner Ward Bell.
Why do you do that to me, John? I'm just... just a guy off the street. I'm the man off the street.
Man, drop you have your podcast. Own Twitter handle for your outfits.
Well, that doesn't everybody.
Well, your
wish.
Outfit is more popular than you.
I gotta go check this out.
Definitely have to, Lori. And Lori, welcome onto the show.
Thanks for having me.
For those of you who want to get a little familiar with Lori here, Lori is a staff software engineer on the learning team at Gatsby.js. She spends a lot of her time teaching tech as an egghead instructor, technical blogger, and conference speaker. Recently, she joined the TC39 Educators Committee and really enjoys looking at all the proposals and bleeding-edge features. In her free time, she's hanging out with her puppy, Avit. Avit? Say it again.
Avit.
Avit! Sorry, Avit. And planning her next trip to Disney, which I think we can all appreciate is a great place to go.
You know, John, as you were reading that and you described her as an egghead instructor, I was thinking, you know, people may not know that. That doesn't mean like she's, you know, just one of those people you can't talk to.
Or maybe her head's shaped like an egg. I don't know.
Yeah,
mine
right.
Kind of is.
Exactly. Egghead is a learning site. And so Laurie is an instructor.
I'm a talking head that looks like an egg on a video.
And Laurie has perhaps the best instructional video I've ever seen in my entire life.
I do. All about how to use a plugin called Peacock, which I'm not sure if you all have heard of this.
Really? Could you please, let me just play along. Peacock, I've got to know more.
Okay, but seriously, this is one of my favorite things. And John knows this, that I talk about this constantly when I talk about plugins that people don't know that they should. Peacock is a plugin that allows you to select a color border for your VS Code window. And the reason I find it incredibly useful is that there are times where I will have multiple windows with seemingly identical files within them. For example, when I was migrating my site from Jekyll to Gatsby, I had markdown files that looked identical. And I would wonder why my changes weren't showing up in my localhost when I was looking at it in the browser, and it was because I was changing it in the old site, not the site that I was running. And so the colors really helped me.
Who wrote that? Who wrote that thing?
This guy, I don't know if you've heard of him. His name's John Papa.
This episode of Real Talk JavaScript brought to you by Egghead.io.
And Peacock.
Not the television channel.
Oh my gosh, I know. NBC announced they're making their streaming service called Peacock. And everyone's like, you have to change the name. I'm like, if they really come after me, I will. But
I don't think you should. You were first.
Yeah, well, I don't know. It's not like I make any money off it anyway, so.
You should. I would pay money for it. I'm not.
This is where my business plan in life has really failed me, by the way. So, hey, let's make a bunch of free software and take all the slack and maintain it, but never actually make money off it.
I mean, you're an instructor in your own right. I feel like that has to have helped with the whole money-making thing.
Yeah, someday. Someday when I grow up, that's what I will do, make money.
Make money.
So today's topic is really interesting to me. We struggled with the title because it's really all centering around something that's near and dear to both Ward and my hearts, on readable code, readable JavaScript in this case. You want to describe a little about what this topic even means to you?
Yeah. So for me, this is, I say human readable JavaScript, and a lot of people come back and they're like, why don't you call it intuitive JavaScript? Why don't you call it, friendly JavaScript or any of that? But I like the idea of human readable because I think it gets to the heart of the fact that humans are all different. And so our answer to this question is going to differ. And that's okay. there's no kind of one right answer. But the idea is, if we're thinking about human-readable JavaScript, we're actually considering the choices that we're making, and then we're making the choices that make the most sense for our current and hopefully future team. So it's about the humans that we employ and work with, and not just kind of this abstract, okay, this is always going to be better, this is always going to be worse. I'm not a big fan of absolutes as kind of a general rule. So I think that really comes out in that designation of human readable code.
Ward, you know, a couple of years ago, you and I sat down and I asked for your advice on this readable code topic, probably about 6-7 years ago. And I got some really good feedback from you on what it means to be readable code. And I was wondering if you could kind of recite to folks kind of how you look at this topic too.
Well, I mean, I start from the premise, and I'll bet you're in the same place, Laurie, that we read the code more often than we write it.
Preach.
And I can never remember what I wrote last week. So why would I expect somebody coming to it new to do otherwise? So, I really believe in the investment in it. And I have certain go-to sort of criteria, and that's why I'm kind of interested in what Laurie's are. I'll just throw a couple out there. You know, one of them is vertical white space. An obvious one I'm sure we all share is picking names that mean something. I don't know if that's what you're referring to, John, in terms of what I talked about, but I know that you and I have put a lot of emphasis in that because, let's face it, you write a lot of code that other people read, and I try to do that too.
Yeah, so Laurie, when you go down there, what are you, like, your main tenets for readable JavaScript?
Yeah, so there's this quote that I found that I use a lot that says, code is readable when it's easy to edit safely. And I feel like there's so much to unpack there, but basically the idea that if you can go into a code base and look at a line, let's say it's got a bug or something else, and you don't have to go digging for 20 minutes to not only figure out what it is that you're reading, but, you know, what it's connected to and how to navigate the code base and all of that. Like, it's easy to find the functions that it's calling. It's easy to figure out what the variables that it's manipulating are. And it's not, you know, pyramid code 6 levels deep with a bunch of ternary operators or spread syntax all over the place and filter reduce on top of map on top of, you all know what I'm kind of getting at. So you can edit it and feel confident that the change you're making is going to work as you intend, because it's a bit of a what you see is what you get. You're reading something and you're like, okay, yeah, I can reason what this is doing without too much extra effort. And so to me, that's a really good standard to abide by. Can I expect that someone can come in and look at this code and start editing without too much fuss?
I think that makes a lot of sense. It resonates with me. And I'm going to give you some pushback that I hear, and I bet you've heard as well of, you know, let's pick on ternaries. I think you and I are both on the same page on ternaries in general are difficult to read at times. But here's the pushback. Go ahead, Ward.
I don't know. I mean, to me, it's easier to read than those deep, long nested ifs. So, but again, I mean, it depends also on what the ternary is. If it fits gracefully on a line, it's easy to read. If the thing after the question mark is suddenly 20 lines or something, then no, of course it isn't. But I love ternaries, so what can I tell you? Do you think they're unreadable?
No, so I don't. I like ternaries. I think there's a lot to like. I think they have their cases where they are completely unreadable. And so that's what I ask people to consider. Kind of look at a situation where you're using a ternary and say, are there 4 of these in a row? Like, if there's more than one ternary, I'm going to tell you I don't agree with that.
You mean like nesting ternaries?
Yeah, don't nest ternaries. It's a terrible decision.
You know, on that note, let's take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. Hey, Ward, you know, I was building an application the other day and I pulled in this really cool UI component, but it brought along a lot of dependencies with it. How do you deal with that?
I don't like that, John. It reminds me that the AG grid, which is an advanced editable data table that we use in a lot of our enterprise apps because it addresses the complex scenarios we encounter. AG Grid doesn't have any dependencies at all.
Zero dependencies. Well, tell me, why is that good? Like, what is the value of having zero dependencies?
Well, it's wonderful not having to wonder if while I'm pulling that in, I'm also pulling jQuery in or Lodash or who knows what, in part because that's extra stuff coming over the wire. It's extra files that I don't know what they're all about. It means when my client's security team has to evaluate this, they're evaluating AG Grid and not everything else that might be slipping in under the covers or something that we have to worry about there.
You know, it's great to see this day and age, you can have a zero dependency library that does something like complex data grid functionality. So all of you out there, do check out AG Grid at their website at ag-grid.com. And we're back, and Lori's telling us we should nest as many ternary operators as possible. That's exactly what I heard.
Now, let me make this really concrete. Let me give you the example.
We're kidding, by the way. We're kidding.
No. Let me make it really concrete about what I mean. I'll show you. Let me give you the code that I want to turn into a ternary.
Okay.
All right. And it reads like this. If X is not null, then return alpha. Else return beta. Close brace. That's five lines of code. Mm-hmm. When it could just...
Or one line in ternary.
Yeah, whereas it's one line with a ternary that makes it ultra clear, yep. Which is return x not equal one. You know, first of all, you can make it positive. So x equals null, question mark, alpha, colon, beta. Bang. I know what it does.
Yep.
Would you agree that's a good use of that then, Lori, in
no
that
problem.
Case? So where does it go awry?
So if you nest a bunch of ternaries, actually, there's a talk I give about this, and there is a FizzBuzz solution that's a single line, and it has, I think, four or five ternaries in there, and it's just completely unreadable. So don't
elegance.
Do that.
That's elegance.
I will also say, and this is just something I've noticed or I've seen, if your ternary question, as it were, if your kind of what would be your if statement is sufficiently complex, I wouldn't try and put it in a ternary because I think what you're doing is you're trying to use a simple statement, but the logic that you're testing is sufficiently complex that probably doesn't make sense. That logic should be its own line.
Totally agree.
Also, if your responses, if your kind of solutions, whether it's on the left-hand side of your colon or the right-hand side, if those are sufficiently complex, if they have their own colon inside a string, don't use a ternary operator. If they are, you know, a bunch of spaces and really, really long sentences because you're using like 50 different CSS classes, maybe don't use a ternary operator. I think if you can very clearly point out, this is my test case, it's A or B, I have no issues with ternary in that scenario.
You know where I see, and I like this, where I see it get a little interesting is when people have, I mean, well, let's say nesting is one extreme. Mm-hmm. And the simple example of alpha, beta, or what you put in there, Lori, is the other extreme, right? Where it's good or bad ternary. But what about the middle where you've got people having a lambda or an arrow mm-hmm. function inside of each condition of the, not the condition, but the expressions in the ternary, or a function that's poorly named?
If you're going to have a lambda, I'm going to ask you to give it a variable name and then call that variable name and make sure that you can jump to its definition really, really fast. I think if you're adding that many extra pieces of syntax, especially things that involve characters like arrow functions do, that's where ternary operators get harder to read. And bad naming is just bad naming. Don't do it. Like, I had someone, tweet about this concept of human-readable JavaScript quite a bit, and I always get the most ridiculous pushback. It shocks me every time. It shouldn't at this point. And someone the other day was arguing with me that they should be able to use fewer characters for variable names because why would they write out the whole thing that makes it harder to read? And I was thinking to myself, I was like,
sorry,
right.
I'm giggling here.
It makes it harder to write. It takes you, 10 different keys on your keyboard. There is very little about names that ever makes anything harder to read because we read so quickly. So why are you saying that iterator should be called ITR instead of just making it iterator? Like, I don't, that's one of those things that I can't get behind when people really push back on the naming convention.
Well, I also don't understand the argument of, because I've heard this too, of, you know, okay, it's 15 characters to write. That's too much to type. Don't the tools in most modern editors allow you to type the first two letters and then you just hit tab?
Autocomplete. Yeah.
Well, and it goes back to that original proposition, which is we're going to read it 10 times more often than we're going
to
write it.
Yeah. So even if it takes you a little bit longer to type it out, I argue that when you look back at this thing, if you know, oh, you mean that's the flux capacitor for the time machine. Gotcha. As opposed to the floca. You know, it's like, what the heck was that thing?
A lot of times people defend this because, or they get a little defensive because they're saying, you know, code I've written that's just for me. Why do I need to care about this? Yeah. I mean, so I make the joke that if you are building your own website, you can do whatever you want because that is where code secrets go to die, right? Like, no one's looking at your personal website repository unless you've somehow made it, you know, open source or public on Git. You can do whatever you want there. You can try out all sorts of quick hacks and funny things. And there is never going to be another project that is only you, because even if it's only you right now, I hope you never want to abandon that project or have another job or switch teams or whatever, because somebody is going to need to come in and take over and learn that code base. And all of your quick little hacks saying, oh, it doesn't matter, it's just me, is going to come bite you in the butt later when they say, no, you can't leave this code base. You have to maintain it forever because no one else can.
And I do want to pause for a moment just to let folks know, if you aren't familiar with the ternary operator, I put some links into the show notes for this. I also put a link into, Lori's going to have a talk about this at an upcoming conference at Dev Intersection in Orlando in April. I put a link to that as well. And also, Lori, have you seen the movie Back to the Future?
I have.
Yeah, that was one that we made a reference to flux capacitor, and Ward Bell was actually in that as the mad scientist, Doc Brown. So for those who hadn't seen it, I put a link into that too.
And in case listeners can't tell, he was kidding about that.
Oh my, Ward's going to get me so bad one of these days.
I am. So when I think, you know, as I think about what we've just talked about, because it's, as we all know, it's not about the ternary operator. We're just using that as a concrete example of your larger point, which is, I don't know. I mean, to me, it's sort of strive to imagine you're reading this and would you get it right away? And if the answer is no, then it's not as readable as it could be.
So let's bring up a really, really contentious thing lately that's been in the JavaScript ecosystem. Let versus const.
Oh, why, John?
Let versus const. Does it matter?
Well,
who cares?
You know, let is only 75% of the characters of const, so that's already speaking for it.
Actually, that's 60.
3 out of 4.
Const is spelled with 5 letters, Ward.
See? All this time, I thought it was a 4-letter word. Because that's my
preferred. That is fantastic.
That's my preferred mode of speech is just 4-letter words all the time.
I thought you were actually kidding.
I didn't. I couldn't count. Oh, I'm embarrassed.
Oh, that was good.
I hope the editor cuts that. Not.
So let versus const is one of those things. I hate the debate because I think, you know, there's more important things that we could be debating that do actually have a pretty big impact on readability and consistent code and even performance for that matter. I remember this originally came up because Dan Abramov brought it up and he regretted that every day since.
Great guy, by the way.
Yes.
Dan's really kind-hearted soul.
Yeah. So he brought this up and he was kind of talking about why he didn't like people making the decisions that they'd made with let versus const. I think let versus const as a debate actually gets to a very specific problem that is the core of almost every debate we've ever had about when you should use one thing versus the other, which is there's a whole set of people that would like to have a very strict rule because they think the syntax is abused by people who don't understand it. This is the same reason that people didn't want to add optional chaining to ECMAScript, which we should throw that in the show notes as well, so I can do that.
Yeah, I'll put a link to that in there.
But for const versus let, one of Dan's points was people think that just putting const in front of your variable assignment makes it immutable, and it doesn't.
Like people, can you describe what immutable means to some folks, who, in case they're not familiar with that?
Yeah, absolutely. So immutable is actually stolen from mathematics, which that's what I majored in college. So I appreciate the fact that it's still a thing I get to talk about. but immutable is the idea that once you've assigned a variable to a value, you cannot change it. You can't override that value. So it's const, like constant. It's a constant value. You're not going to change it, which is something a lot of people are familiar with in other languages. The problem with const in JavaScript is that JavaScript doesn't actually enforce this. So people use const more as signifying intent than they do as something that the language is really, you know, making sure happens. And the debate comes with, well, if it doesn't actually do that, isn't it misleading to use that? People don't really understand what it's actually doing under the hood and what it's actually preventing you from doing. And it goes back to education. It just, people want to debate this because they're afraid of the fact that people don't understand what's happening in the implementation of JavaScript, which has been every JavaScript debate that has ever happened. There's people who understand it at the surface level, and there's people who understand it at a deeper level. And the deeper level people are scared of the surface level people, which is my long-winded way of saying that I don't know that it really matters, but if you want to learn what const does, go ahead and learn it. I don't know that it's actually going to affect the performance or readability of your code in the long term.
You know, I agree with you. And I think the biggest reason, in my opinion, this comes up a lot is because there is an ESLint rule of prefer const.
Yes.
So people turn that on, or it's on by default based upon which rules that they grab. And all of a sudden they've got 5,000 or 50 error messages saying you're using const, or you're using let, you should be using const instead. And then they start going down this rabbit hole. And at the end of the day, maybe they make the decision a day later and they fix it or they change it. And it's like, did it actually improve their code?
So I'm going to make the case for const.
Ooh.
All right. Cause I like that rule and I use it, and it's a bit, and I found it to be, and here's why I have found actually the distinction to be useful.
Can I pause you though and give people some context for if I think we're really talking about the situations where people use let in a case where it's the variable's only to set one time.
Correct.
That's usually the big place where people debate between let and const. And go ahead, Ward.
That's precisely it. It declares my intention that the assignment is immutable. The variable holds a reference to a value, and I will not change that again. And that, and by the way, the editors and the language do enforce that, right? They don't, you know, the confusion is that the value you've assigned will be immutable. That's not what const says. And if you go to the documentation, it's quite clear. What it says is that variable will have to have an initial value and will not be reassigned. That's what const means. And if you know that's what const means, then that's a very useful piece of information. It means that every time I see whatever X is, which by the way is the most readable variable name you can ever use. That's why X is kind of like, I believe that all variable names should be renamed X.
I like the capital O, actually, so okay, you can get confused between zero and O.
Ward is kicked off the episode now. and not because of his view on const.
But you know, that's why I love the const let distinction. Let reminds me that I'm going to that if I'm looking at this variable, I should expect it to be reassigned. If I see const, I'm saying I do not expect that to ever be reassigned. It doesn't mean that the value won't be mutated. It means that the variable will not be reassigned. That's all it means. Now, I've always understood that. I guess what you're telling us, Laurie, is that that in the grand debate, people d- don't know that's what it means. They think it means that the value is immutable.
Right. Which, and to be clear, your explanation was far superior than mine to me. When I was saying that you can't change stuff, I should have been talking about, you know, the value, not the variable, because that confuses people. And you're absolutely right. I think, yeah, the debate is over whether people actually know that's what it's doing. I don't have an issue with using it if you're on a team of people who know that that is the intent and everyone agrees that that's what you're trying to say. Again, I don't really feel like I have a horse in this race.
But to me, its value is it's not only communication, but it also keeps me from a certain class of bugs, which is where the variable changed, was reassigned, and I wasn't expecting it.
All right, so this has got to lead us to the topic of linters and style guides, which is something you brought in. So go for it, Lori.
I have no problem with Ward having a lint rule for const and keeping it in there. I have a problem. Sorry, I'm going to pick on you.
Go for it.
I have a problem if Ward is the senior engineer on a project, has implemented a lint rule for every personal opinion he's ever had or wanted to have, and then the rest of his team is sitting there scratching their heads saying, why am I forced to have two characters of space after every curly brace that shows up in my code, and why does it break if I don't?
Got it. Got it. Well, and of course, I do have that rule.
I've worked on his projects.
Hey, my rule is whoever sets the rules, live with them and get on with life. Because having rules is the obviously I don't mean that one. I mean, not spurious rules. Every rule should have a justification. But fighting over it. Like if I'm on some rule, if somebody tells me, hey, you know, in our code base, you got to have a carriage return after that. You know, hey, it's your base, man. I'm just here to get along. And so bike shedding, this is the classic example, let const.
Yep.
All right, Ward, you got to explain what bike shedding means, because I'm convinced there are people out there who don't know what that means.
There's a huge number of people who don't understand it. And they've gone this whole time kind of like pretending that they do because they're embarrassed now and they shouldn't be.
What's wrong, man? I put my bike in.
Let's see if I can get it right. So bike shedding is when there is just a lot of really important stuff to talk about, but it's really difficult. So everybody in the room decides to find the thing that's not difficult to talk about and puts enormous energy into that. And so avoids the things that really matter. And it comes from, I think it was a nuclear power plant, and they had all kinds of design and engineering issues to consider, but they were also going to build a shed for bicycles, and everybody went nuts on the bike shed because at least everybody knew what they were talking about there. And all the difficult design problems around the nuclear reactor were just sort of like, hey, we'll get to those, but this bike shed, this has got to be right. And so it's like this code base, this is a mess, but man, we're going to get const versus let right.
But Lori, isn't the whole idea of linters just pick one, pick a linter, pick a set of rules, move along? Or should we instruct folks to sit down and actually have a conversation about all the rules that are in there?
So pick one should be the way that linters are used. Just go ahead and find one that works for most of your situations and make use of it. And if you need to add some specific rule at some point because of issues you're having with your team and your code base and something you really want to enforce, okay. That is not how I've seen them used in practice. In practice, I have seen more custom lint rule files than you can possibly imagine, and I have no idea why. I think it comes from severe bike shedding on behalf of whoever was put in charge of the code base initially, and then other team members join and they say, no, this is wrong, that's not how I do this, or this, or this, or this, or this, and so they try and pen everybody in with these really excessive linter rules, which don't help your team. They don't help your culture. And honestly, they don't help your code base because you end up having people who spend all their time trying to write their code to pass the linter rules instead of actually focusing on.
Well, what's the point of a linter? I mean, really? I mean, we all use them.
Yeah.
But what is the point of a linter?
to me, I think linters are really good for consistency to a point. So there are things that linters can do so that, you know, when it's on your machine and you do kind of like auto format and things like that, everyone's looking at the same code base. When you push stuff to Git, all of a sudden, if you have linter hooks, you have, you're not seeing changes where you shouldn't have seen changes because people just had things styled slightly differently on their local machines. There are really good things about linters. Enforcing code standards beyond a certain point isn't one of them, in my opinion.
By the way, we had a really good episode on linters. I think it was episode 62. I'll put in the show notes by Alexandra. And she did a great talk about doing this. We actually recorded that when Craig Shoemaker and I over at Microsoft Ignite last fall. I'm with you, though. I use linters a lot. I worked on a lot of large-scale apps. Mm-hmm. And having some kind of rules is important for consistency. So, you know, I always look at why. Why do I like linters? Because I like consistent code. Why do I like consistent code? Because I like to avoid bike shedding, mm-hmm. as Ward pointed out. And I just feel like when you've got lots of people on a project, what do I want to focus on? I want to focus on making sure the code works, improving the code, adding new features, making sure it doesn't have regressions when I add new code for tests and whatnot. I don't want to focus on is, hey, Lori, I know you made that pull request and you only changed one line of code, but it's got 92 files that yep. are updated because you used let and Ward used const. And, you know, let's get in a room and have a big meeting for 7 hours and discuss it.
Yep. No, and I think based on what you have said and based on what Ward has said, you are likely responsible lint file users. You have not created weird, somewhat archaic and random rules just because of personal opinion and choice.
There should be a badge for that. I think you should create that badge, Lori.
I'm a responsible linter. I would like to give it out to, let me tell you.
Lint guru.
And on that note, this episode has been brought to you by... No. So let's take a quick break from a word from our sponsors.
Are you building a web application? Need to deliver it soon and don't have the people to do it? Maybe you're not sure your company has the skill set or experience to do it. And maybe we can help. I'm your host, Ward Bell, and my day job is building applications for companies like yours. I don't do it alone. I'm president of IdeaBlade, a consultancy that specializes in enterprise web application development. We're particularly strong in Angular, RxJS, NGRX Redux on the front end, and .NET and Microsoft technologies on the server. We're a small, tight-knit group of people handpicked by me for their expertise, experience, integrity, and team spirit. Maybe we can help you with architectural guidance and hands-on development. And if there's something we don't know, and in our field, really, there's too much to know, we can draw on our personal connections in the Microsoft RD, MVP, and Google GDE networks, as well as our international circle of really great developers, people we know and trust personally. If you got a project that's keeping you up at night, shoot us an email at info@ideablade.com. That's info@ideablade.com. And now back to the show.
So, Lori, what do you think about comments in code? What kind of comments help? What kind of Well, you know, if we're going to talk let versus const, you got to talk about comments. There's an extreme position out there that says if you need a comment, it must be that you didn't write clear code. So anyway, what's your thought?
There is this myth of the self-commenting code base, right? That if you write really well-named variables and functions and things are logically done, that you won't ever need a comment. I don't believe that's true. I think that there are plenty of comments that could probably be removed from code bases with more human readable code. If you do that kind of low-hanging fruit of well-named variables and function names, and you try and make things read in a way that's intuitive and not super pyramid-y and all of that, yes. There are comments, I'm sure, in many of our code bases that could be removed that say something like, oh, I had to do it this way because this is calling this thing. And just so you know, it's a loop with a thing which changes the whatever. I'm making lots of sense, but you know what I mean. That being said, comments are really helpful for telling people why. Like, if there's a random three somewhere, you're getting modulo 3 and someone wants to know why that's there, you should probably comment and say, hey, we want this to be, you know, happening every 3 days. And if it's more than that, we just go to the most recent day. We don't round up. And that's why this 3 is there. Business logic wise, basically. Those are necessary in code sometimes because, I don't know, I'm not going to name a variable 3 if it's only used once.
Why not?
Actually.
No, I'm serious.
For
like
that
why?
One, I would, actually. I would have called it.
And that's fair.
But your point, your essential point, is exactly where I come down. If there's a business, the why is that you want to comment where there's a why and it's not obvious why.
Yeah, coming up with an example for that on the fly is not really easy. Because as soon as I said that, I was like, no, wait, I actually would make that a variable.
No, and I was just teasing there, but I'm going to play a little devil's advocate because I give a talk that talks about exactly the opposite of what you're saying. Saying don't use the comments, make self commenting code, self documenting code, etc. Mm-hmm. And I actually agree with everything you said, but the reason I go this direction is because I've spent too many years in my experience on teams where I've walked into a team and they said, "Well, to catch up to speed on this project," and they slapped down this 300-page tome of documentation. And then I look at it and I notice that it's been dated like 2 years ago or 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I say, well, has this been updated? Well, no, but you know, if you feel like anything out of date, you could update it. Like, well, how the heck would I know what needs to be updated if I'm trying to catch up to speed in this? And this happens a lot at big organizations where you've got these documentation, these diagrams and things that just don't represent. So it's not so much the code comments. It's the idea that documentation solves all problems. I feel is a complete myth. The code comments, when it explains why, is excellent advice. I totally agree with you. But here's a difficult question for you. What if you, as the developer, don't entirely know how to articulate why? What do you do?
Yeah, that's a fair point. And I would answer that question, but you just attacked my livelihood, so I got to go back. documentation solves all problems, Ward. No. I write documentation as a huge part of my job. I work on the learning team at Gatsby. We have focused a lot of our time and effort on making really robust documentation. We are an open source project, so that changes things a little bit, right? But the idea that you walk into a company and they say, here's our giant documentation. If it's out of date, let us know. Has so many levels of problems to it, I don't even know where to
yes.
start. But the thing I would start with is, can we stop treating documentation like it's an add-on? If you are writing code and someone needs to know how to use it, this is not the why you wrote it the way that you did. This is how you can configure it. If you want to test it or run it yourself, this is how you do that.
Yes.
If you want to extend it, this is the hook, or these are the API calls that are available to you. All of those things, you need documentation. And that means all of your code needs documentation. And the person who wrote the feature, the documentation is part of that feature, because there's no point in shipping code if the people who need to interact with it can't and don't know how. So comments are a whole other issue related to being a dev in the code base and learning how it was written. But documentation should cover interacting with that code base, and we do ourselves a disservice when we treat it as a second-class citizen that can be, you know, unupdated for a year or 2 years, or we'll do a brand new release and say, okay, we'll document it later, but let's push it out in production into the world because we're trying to meet a deadline. Don't do that. Stop doing it.
Very, very well said. I really agree.
I'm so with you. Every public member of a class, I think, unless its name is just so blindingly obvious and it can't have any, you can't have any questions about it, should be, you know, that's part of the API, and the API should be documented. So I feel like that. I don't want to see something, if the thing says, get the foo, then I don't want a comment to say, it gets the foo.
Agreed.
And how many times have you actually read that? That's like everywhere.
I know. It's like They got code document generators that do that stuff for you. And it's just.
Exactly. It's I blame Swagger a little bit. And I love Swagger. Don't get me wrong. I think Swagger has great documentation for APIs and great kind of self-generating documentation. Because when you have the public-facing thing, you don't actually see the function signature. And so you don't know these are the variables, these are the parameters that are getting passed in, and this is what it returns and all of that. I'm with that. But inside the code base, oh man, does it feel redundant.
I'm 100% with you on the need for good documentation. And I work for a company, Microsoft, who has really rich docs, and we're always trying to improve them. So it's not there yet. Like everything we work on is always not there yet. We always got to make it better. But I think my biggest problem with this topic in general is not so much that I feel like documentation is bad or comments are bad. It's that I don't think that people really prioritize comments and documentation the way we should. And therefore, why? Maybe we don't teach this well enough. Like when we're learning these topics, whether it's at a job and on the job training, or it's in college or in other school or vocational or wherever you learn this stuff, do we not teach this? Like, how do you actually make your work readable to other people? And I think we need to do that. I mean, Lori, I let's go. You and I, we're going to start a new company today. Readable JavaScript.
Yep.
And we're going to teach people how to make it readable. What do you think?
I'm good. I think the reason we're in this pickle to begin with, I just sounded very Southern just then. I'm not. I think the reason we have this problem, I call it the problem with experts. And it's the idea that within our industry, we have decided that someone is an expert if I can be in awe of their code for all the wrong reasons. So if you're in awe of someone's code because you feel like it's something you could never write, that is not an expert.
I agree.
If you're in awe of someone's code because they made something really complicated and you understand what they wrote, that is an expert, making the complex, quote unquote, simple. And so we made it kind of a bad thing to have comments and documentation because that says something about the intelligence of the reader and the expertise of the reader. If they were smart, they could figure it out for themselves. And I think we're finally figuring out that no one is ever going to be able to understand code by just looking at it, even if they're the smartest developer that you've ever met, because I can't remember what I wrote 2 weeks ago, let alone 2 years ago.
I'm making a decision right now. We do have to wrap up on time, but I want to invite you back to talk about comments in general, if you're willing to do so.
Of course. I'm happy to come back. We're going to be talking about all the things that are like the third rail, fifth rail, whatever that phrase is.
That's right. That's me counting how many letters there are in const.
That's going to be the title of this episode. There are only const is a four-letter word.
Oh, man. Now everyone's going to think I wanted in on that debate.
Of course you did. It was your idea, Laurie.
It was all your idea. We have full editing abilities here, and we'll make everything come out of your mouth. Just kidding.
Oh my gosh, that's Disney.
All right. Hey, Lori, thanks for coming on so much. And we want to, again, invite you back on, if you're willing to do so, to talk about comments at a future date. But we like to end our episode with final thoughts for our listener. And this could be on topic or off topic, anything that you are wanting to share with folks. And I will start with you, Lori.
So we got into a topic of documentation at the end there. And I would say, if you are someone who's learning or someone who's experienced and you have the time and the energy to devote to open source documentation is an incredible, incredible place to put your time and your energy because it has, you know, benefits kind of across the board. So this is my pitch for please contribute to open source documentation. Every single project needs it.
Excellent. And Mr. Bell, what is your final thought for folks?
Well, we talked about bike shedding. And I think we should therefore learn about yak shaving. So I put a note in there.
Can you yak shave while you bike shave?
As a matter of fact, they're best done together. yak shaving is a closely related process. And I put a link in there. But basically, what it says, you have some end goal. And you find 15 things that are going to get you on the way there. So here's one. It's the art of doing something you have to do before you can do something that you have to do before you can do something that you have to do before you can do something important. I think
my brain.
I yak shave a fair amount.
Deep thoughts by Ward Bell.
Yeah. So I just think there you go. That's mine.
So you're encouraging yak shaving.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's just recognize when you're doing it.
Oh, geez. Thank you. And my final thought for folks is there's actually a talk I've done, and I've done it in a while, but it's something I believe in quite a bit. And maybe I'd actually love to have Lori on to talk about this sometime. I like to come up with weird acronyms and titles for things. And the title I came up for this was this concept of the 7 D's of development. And the 7 D's of development are basically a checklist of 7 things that you should do before you, in the process of creating your code and deploying it. And here they are in no particular order. Designing your code, developing your code, which generally is where most of us stop. Write the code, we're done, ship it. And then the third one is documentation, document your code. So I do believe in it. Destroy your code, testing it. In whatever testing way you feel is appropriate, end-to-end and unit integration, whatever. Demo for your code, which we can talk about more in a future episode. Everybody always writes something that tests to make sure it actually functions in some way, like a harness app. Why not put that demo right inside your app in a monorepo and include tests for that? The next one is what I call the review, because I'm Italian. And I couldn't come up with a D for code reviews. So you got to go do the review.
Demoralize your coworkers.
Make sure there's a review process in some case. And then the 7th one, which is probably the most important and the place you can ultimately fail, and I've seen it a lot, deploy it. I've seen a lot of places where I've been, where I've had all this stuff written up, great CI processes, and in the end, we just never pressed the button or had an automation that actually deployed the code. So you finished your work, but nobody got to it. It's kind of like having a great product to sell, but you never put it on the shelves of Walmart or on Amazon, so nobody knows about it. So those are the 7 D's. And I think it's a really good process. Whether you change those 7 to your 3 or your 22 list, I think having some kind of deployment list that you can look at and have your team agree on is a really, really good way to get consistent. So, again, thank you all for coming onto the show. Lori.
What is that?
That was my sound bite. That's the peacock, the sound of a peacock.
I'm like, did somebody step on Ward?
We were talking peacock earlier, and I said, we need a soundtrack for that.
I think that just sounds like someone's going to think their headphones are broken.
I was like, what is going on?
I'm sorry. I had to sneak that in before Lori got hers in. Sorry.
Okay. Chris, feel free to use that as you will. Chris is our editor out there, everybody. And hey, thank you, everybody, for coming onto our show and listening to us. So many episodes into here and so much more to do. We have got 3 months of great guests coming on board. And Lori, are you coming back to see us?
Yeah, happy to.
Awesome. And I'm looking forward to seeing you at Dev Intersections April in Orlando and your talks that you have there.
Yeah, everyone come hang out in Disney World with us.
Woo! All right. Thanks, everybody. And we will see you and you'll hear from us every Tuesday morning.
Thanks for listening to Real Talk JavaScript. This show and all of our shows are available at www.realtalkjs.com with links and notes. John and Ward would love to hear what you think, especially about potential guests and topics for future shows. Follow and send them a message on Twitter @RealTalkJS.